Shalom, Hut of Our students. Shalom, Hut of Our Knicks. Welcome to the Hut of Our Messianic Ministry School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. We're studying the Jewish life of the Messiah. This is the 2021 edition. This is Lesson 9, and we are in Session 35. So, let's go ahead and review Session 34. In Session 34, we encounter the story of the rich man and Lazarus. Rabbinic theology taught that if God favored you with material blessings, then you were guaranteed entrance to heaven. You were blessed. So the rich man expected to enter heaven when he died, but not so much of an expectation for Lazarus. Lazarus was a beggar. He was a poor man. God was not favoring him. God was not blessing him, and therefore his chances of getting to heaven were pretty slim. Well, both died and went to the place of the dead during this dispensation. The place of the dead was Sheol or Hades, made up of two compartments. One compartment, a place of torment, and the other compartment called Abraham's bosom or paradise, a place of grace and joy. And between the two was a great chasm that could not be crossed. And so the rich man, surprisingly, found himself in the place of torment, and Lazarus was in paradise. And there was a great gap, a great chasm between the two, and the rich man cried out to Father Abraham, "Send Lazarus back, resurrect Lazarus, so that my brothers can be warned and not come to this place of torment." And Abraham's response was, "They have Moses and the prophets. That's enough information for them." But the rich man replied, No, it's not, Father Abraham. They don't believe Moses and the prophets, but they will believe if there's a spectacular resurrection of Lazarus. Then they'll believe. And that isn't true either. A spectacular resurrection of Lazarus will not bring them to faith. Then we spent a few moments speaking of an application of the previous lesson. The theme I chose for the application, lessons from the Messiah. We saw 9 lessons. He taught on a lesson of entrance into the kingdom. He taught about true Sabbath rest, about humility, respect for people, and discipleship. Going on, he taught of God's attitude toward sinners, wealth, forgiveness, and service. The lessons Messiah taught in this lesson. And then Yeshua was living or staying temporarily in the region of Bethany beyond the Jordan. And he received an emergency call from another Bethany. He received a call from Bethany in Judea. The call came from Mary and Martha, Lazarus's sisters, because Lazarus was sick and about to die. They sent a messenger to Yeshua, urging him to come. It was a 9/11 call. Come and save the one you love from death. Well, because Yeshua did love Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, he stayed where he was a short while. And then only after Lazarus was dead did he make his way from Bethany beyond the Jordan across the Jordan River up to Bethany in Judea. And I showed you some pictures of Bethany in Judea around the late 1800s. Probably looked pretty much this way when Yeshua walked its streets as well. Well, he got to Bethany in Judea and he resurrected Lazarus. Lazarus, come forth. This was the first sign of Jonah promised for the nation, the sign of resurrection. And this sign was rejected. Sign was rejected by the nation, by the leaders of the nation. And as a result, Yeshua leaves the area of Bethany in Judea, leaves the Bethany Jerusalem area, and he goes north to a little town called Ephraim, about 15 miles north. And he spends some time there in Ephraim. There's nothing recorded about what happened in Ephraim. We just know that he stayed there for a short time. Then when the time was proper, he left Ephraim and he went to the area between Samaria, and Samaria is this general area here, is between Samaria and Galilee, this general area here. So he left Ephraim, took the main road, and went to this area in the Jezreel Valley, right between Samaria and Galilee. There he healed 10 lepers and sent them to the priests. And so the high priest who had rejected, Caiaphas, who had rejected his messiahship, is now faced with a 10-fold examination of these lepers and a tenfold attestation that Jesus is the Messiah, because healing a leper was a messianic miracle. Well, this brings us now to the new material. We're in sections 174 through 181, and we'll begin with section 174. Now, sections 174 to 181 take place on the way to Jerusalem. He now moves down the Jezreel Valley, back over to Perea, then south through Perea, and his ultimate objective, of course, is Jerusalem. So he's on his way back to Jerusalem for the last time, when we pick it up here in section 174. And section 174 deals with instructions regarding the second coming of Jesus the Messiah. It'll be Luke chapter 17, 22 through 37. So let's pick it up here on verse 22. Yeshua will point out five lessons about his second coming. First of all, when he returns, when the Messiah returns, all men will see him like a lightning flash in the sky. Here we are with verse 22. And he said to the disciples, "The days will come when you will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. They will say to you, 'Look there, look here.' Do not go away. Do not run after them. For just as the lightning, when it flashes out of one part of the sky, shines to the other part of the sky, so will the Son of Man be in his day." And so the second coming will be unmistakably obvious, just as a lightning flash is unmistakably obvious. Even if you have your back turned toward it, you know when lightning has flashed. And Yeshua will describe his coming, Matthew 24, 29, and 30. We'll get to this in a short time. "But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory." So his return will be unmistakably obvious, but other events must occur before the second coming. Verse 25. "But first he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation." So one of the things that must happen first is the rejection of the first coming by that generation of Jewish people. Verse 26. "And just as it happened in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating, they were drinking, they were marrying, they were being given in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. And it was the same as happened in the days of Lot. They were eating, they were drinking, they were buying, they were selling, they were planting, they were building. But on the day that Lot went out from Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all." So next, the tribulation must occur before the second coming. And the tribulation will descend suddenly while men are doing their normal activities, eating, drinking, getting married, all that stuff. Just like a normal day, just like in the days of Noah and Lot, and suddenly the tribulation is upon them. Verse 30. "It will be just the same on the day that the Son of Man is revealed. On that day, the one who's on the housetop and whose goods are in the house must not go down to take them out. And likewise, the one who is in the field must not turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to keep his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. I tell you that on that night there will be two in one bed. One will be taken, the other will be left. There will be two women grinding at the same place. One will be taken, and the other will be left. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken, and the other will be left." So after the tribulation, then the second coming will occur and its subsequent judgments. And so this section here, verses 30 through 36, is not a reference to the rapture. This is not a reference to the rapture. Please note the preceding verses, verses 30 and 31. It will be just the same on the day that the Son of Man is revealed, second coming. On that day, on the second coming, that's when this will occur. All right, verse 37. And answering, they said to him, Where, Lord? And he said, where the body is, there also the vultures will be gathered. So now he talks about the location of the second coming, and he gives a very cryptic answer. And that word vultures is the best translation, like the NASB has translated the word, much better than eagles, as the King James translated the word. As the vultures will be gathered where the body is. Now, this verse can only be understood in light of parallel passages. Before we go into the parallel passages, let's review the chronological sequence of events to make sure we have it firmly in our minds. First of all, there's the rejection of his first coming, then the tribulation period, then the second coming and subsequent judgments, and that's when the location of the second coming is important. All right, so I'll go through. What I'm going to do is go through the campaign of Armageddon, but I'm not going to spend any time on the parallel passages, but I'll be summarizing what they teach. The supporting verses are in your chart, the campaign of Armageddon on page 57. And so a detailed look at the campaign of Armageddon would be a movement through all of those verses as well. But we will just give you an overview because we're focusing here on the location of the second coming. And I want you to understand why Yeshua says what he says. Now, the position I take on the campaign of Armageddon is the position developed by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum in his book, Footsteps of the Messiah. I feel Arnold has done the best job of putting together the chronological sequence of events than any I've ever read. And I've read a number of them. All right, let's take a look and see what happens here. Let's run through the campaign of Armageddon first, and then I'll run through a map of the same steps, and you'll be able to see more clearly how the campaign of Armageddon unravels. All right, we start with step number one, the Antichrist armies assemble at Armageddon. Step two, the Antichrist then joins his army. Step three, the destruction of Babylon, the city of Babylon. Step four, the fall of Jerusalem. Step five, the tribulation holocaust begins and the Jewish flight to Basra, also known as Petra. The armies of the Antichrist then besiege Basra. That leads to the national regeneration of Israel, step number seven. And the national regeneration of Israel leads to the second coming of the Messiah in step eight. The Messiah then treads the winepress, step 9. Step 10, the fighting ends in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And step 11, there's a victory ascent up the Mount of Olives. All right, that's the basic flow of the campaign of Armageddon. Now let's map it on out for you so you can see exactly where and exactly why the second coming is stated as the place where the vultures will be circling. They're showing off the corpse. All right, let's begin here. We begin with stage number one. The Antichrist armies assemble at Armageddon, at Har Megiddo, the mountain of Megiddo. The mountain of Megiddo overlooks the Jezreel Valley. And so all the nations of the world will send men and materiel to the Jezreel Valley. It's the gathering place for the armies of the Antichrist. Now, here's a picture of the Jezreel Valley from Har Megiddo. I'm standing on Har Megiddo looking out across the valley, and you can see it's a huge, huge valley. Plenty of room for lots of soldiers and lots of war materiel. Now, off on the north there is the little town of Nazareth, the city of Nazareth. So my next picture will be from Nazareth looking back toward Har Megiddo. Now, here we are at Nazareth looking back across the valley. And again, you can get an idea of how big and flat and perfect this valley is for a gathering place for the armies of the Antichrist. This is the staging area. No battle occurs here, but the armies are assembled in this area. Well, Babylon is the religious, political, and economic capital of the world at that time. And that means that Babylon has to be rebuilt, and it is in the process of being rebuilt. This is some pictures taken by one of our Marines who was over there, I believe, in 2003. and took pictures of how Saddam Hussein had proceeded on the rebuilding of Babylon. Now, this area will probably be the historical center of the city, with a modern city all around it, but it'll probably be revered for its historical value. So Babylon is being rebuilt and will be the religious, political, and economic capital of the world. So this brings us to the Antichrist, the Antichrist joins his troops stage two of the campaign of Armageddon. He leaves his capital and he goes over to Har-Megiddo, where his headquarters is set up. Now this brings on the third stage, the destruction of Babylon. This is the first battle of the campaign of Armageddon. We learn from Jeremiah 51, 27, and 28 that the nations are the kingdoms of Ararat, Mini, and Ashkenaz, off the map there, all joined together. They all joined together, ally with a fourth kingdom, the kingdom of the Medes, and they come south on a surprise attack against the capital city of Babylon. And Babylon is destroyed quickly and decisively and completely consistently with the requirements of the Bible. You know, Babylon has never been destroyed in the manner that the Bible states that it will be destroyed. But it will be destroyed in that manner quickly and completely during the tribulation period. So the Babylon is flattened to the ground. Then we come to the fourth stage, the fall of Jerusalem. This is the second battle of the campaign of Armageddon. The Antichrist, whose headquarters is at Har-Megiddo, on the mountain of Megiddo, does not defend his city. He has another city in mind. He sends his troops south against Jerusalem. And there a horrendous battle occurs, a horrendous battle, and the IDF fights like no other time, and yet the IDF eventually is defeated, and Jerusalem falls to the armies of the Antichrist. This brings us to the fifth stage. The tribulation holocaust begins. This is the middle of the tribulation now, and the Jewish flight to Basra, also called Petra. Those who survive the battle from the north flee for refuge to Basra, or also known as Petra, located in the Mount Seir mountain range in southern Jordan, old ancient Edom. So this is the most important body of Jewish people in the world. This is probably the leadership, both spiritual and political and military leadership of the nation there in Basra. And this is a picture of the Mount Seir mountain range, a small snippet of the mountain range. You can see it's very, very rugged, a very, very amazing place to be. Now here is a sheepfold. The word Basra, the city of Basra, means sheepfold because it's shaped like a sheepfold. It's within the Mount Seir mountain range and there's one way in and out. So here's a temporary sheepfold that a shepherd would put together out in the desert, and there's the one door in and out. And here's a permanent sheepfold that a shepherd might build, and again, one door in and out. And here is a village sheepfold, again, one door in and out. And here is the entrance into the sheepfold. This is the Sikh, the entry canyon into Basra or Petra. It's a very defendable city. The entry canyon, the Sikh, is a mile-long twisting defile, a crack in the rocks that leads you to the city. When you come to the end of the Sikh, you begin to see the city, and you come face to face with the amazing treasury. And the treasury is carved out of the sheer wall of the Mount Seir mountain range and the valley there. And it's supposed to be impressive. That's where it was placed there, and that's why it looks the way it does. Now, here, we're going to go through this doorway and turn around and take a look at the Sikh. So we're inside the treasury, and we're looking out, and there's the Sikh out there, the exit from the Sikh as you walk out this split in the mountain range. Now, this is the area from above. It doesn't look so impressive here, does it? There's the treasury on the left, and you can see the pathway into Basra. When you get into Basra, you can see the amazing, amazing buildings carved out of the cliffs, carved out of the mountains themselves. There's the Deir, or the monastery. Just an amazing, amazing place. Well, that's where the Jewish people will be holed up for refuge with the Jerusalem falls. So this brings us to the sixth stage of the campaign of Armageddon. The armies of the Antichrist besiege Bozrah. You know, the Antichrist does not want any Jewish people to get away. He wants to annihilate them all. So he sends his troops south to Bozrah, and they set up a siege ring around the city. They put the city under siege. Well, that brings us to the seventh stage, the national regeneration of Israel. The siege lasts about 3.5 years, but toward the end of that 3.5 years, the Jewish people see that they can't hold out too much longer. And this leads them to come to faith in Jesus the Messiah. We learn that at the end of the tribulation period in the book of Romans, Romans 11, at the very end of the chapter, we learn that every living Jewish man, woman, and child places their faith in Jesus the Messiah, becomes born again, and then we plead for Yeshua to return. So a saved nation begins to plead for the Messiah to come back. And Yeshua heeds our pleas. This brings us to the eighth stage, the second coming of the Messiah. He heeds our cry, and the initial point of the second coming is Bozrah. This is the initial point of the second coming, where the body is, the vultures will be gathered. And this is all laid out in this cross-reference, Micah 2, 12 and 13. I will surely assemble all of you, Jacob. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together like sheep in the fold. Better translation is a proper noun. I'll put them together like sheep of Bozrah. Like a flock in the midst of the pasture, they will be noisy with men. The breaker goes up before them. They break out and pass through the gate and go out by it. So their king goes on before them, and Yahweh at their head. Yahweh saves the Jewish people at Bozrah. So here's a picture. The initial point of the second coming is Bozrah, and I'll use this sheepfold to illustrate Bozrah. Yeshua descends to planet Earth again, and the initial point of his descent is Bozrah, the city of Bozrah. And then the breaker, King Messiah, breaks the siege and leads his people to safety. The breaker goes out before them. That's Yahweh himself, Jesus the Messiah. And then step nine occurs. The Messiah treads the winepress. This is the third battle of the campaign of Armageddon. Now, the winepress imagery comes from the processing of wine from grape juice. The grapes are thrown into the wine press, and they are crushed by the workers. And as the grapes are crushed, their blood, their wine, their juice freely flows. And this is the field of battle from Joel 2:20, these red dots. So Yeshua will tread the vine press out of Bozrah down to Teman. Teman is probably where the Antichrist will be headquartered. And then he treads the winepress into the wilderness of Paran, and then north into the Negev, through the Negev. And as he does, he pushes the armies of the Antichrist into the eastern and western sea, and he approaches Jerusalem from the south. And that's a winepress of approximately 200 miles in length. The tenth stage is the end of the fighting in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, many people feel the Kidron is the Valley of Jehoshaphat. I don't agree with them, but I do agree that Yeshua will tread the winepress up the Valley of Jehoshaphat to the base of the Mount of Olives. And then he will do a victory ascent up the Mount of Olives. There's the base of the Mount of Olives, and there's his victory ascent. And when he reaches the top of the Mount of Olives, he will have victory over the enemies of Israel, over the armies of the Antichrist. Victory on the Mount of Olives. But our key here is the location of the second coming. In Luke 17:37, and answering, they said to him, "Where, Lord?" And he said to them, "Where the body is, there also the vultures will be gathered." So the body is Israel. The vultures are the Gentile armies. And as they encircle Bozrah with a siege activity, then that's very clear. The vultures will very clearly show where the body is located. And so during the second coming, the body of Israel will be in the land of Edom, in the city of Bozrah or Petra. And that's where the vultures, the Gentile armies, will gather together. They'll circle around Basra, put it in a siege. And so the initial point of the second coming will be obvious to all. Everybody will know where the Jewish people are located, just as a circling vulture makes obvious the location of the corpse. Everybody's going to know exactly where the battle is going to take place. And so Israel and the Gentile armies are gathered together in the city of Basra in southern Jordan, and then the second coming of the Messiah will occur. Isaiah 34, 1 through 7, Isaiah 63, 1 through 6. And so a detailed explanation of this belongs to a study of eschatology or to the prophets. So I would encourage you to do exactly that. Buy the book, Footsteps of the Messiah, that I showed you earlier, and you'll get the full details on the campaign of Armageddon. All right, now we're in Lesson 9, page 58 at the top of the page, section 175, two parables on prayer, the importunate widow and the Pharisee and the publican. We move now to Luke chapter 18 for these two lessons on prayer. Now let's pick it up on verses 1 through 8. Now he was telling them a parable to show that at all times they ought to pray and not to lose heart, saying, "In a certain city there was a judge who did not fear God and did not respect man. There was a widow in that city, and she kept coming to him, saying, 'Give me legal protection from my opponent.' For a while he was unwilling, but afterward he said to himself, 'Even though I do not fear God or respect man, yet because this widow bothers me, I will give her legal protection. Otherwise, by continually coming, she will wear me out.' And the Lord said, 'Hear what the unrighteous judge said. Now, will not God bring about justice for his elect, who cry out to him day and night? And will he delay long over them? I tell you that he will bring about justice for them quickly. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?" Well, as I studied this, I ran across this slideshow, the parable of the persistent widow, on freebibleimages.org, and they let you use their images in your lessons. So I thought this would be a great little series of images to present to you regarding this parable. So we begin here with the unrighteous judge. He's hearing legal cases in the city. Here's a woman coming to him with her needs, and then the widow comes and she places her case before him, and he rejects her. "Get out of here. I don't want to hear that." So he rejects her. Next day, he's hearing cases, and there's the widow again, and he sends her away a second time. "Listen, I told you, I don't want to hear your case." The third day, people are coming to him, and the widow comes to him again. And this time, he again sends her away with no legal protection. The next day, the people come again to the unrighteous judge, and guess what? There's the widow, but she's pursuing him this time. She's really bugging him this time. And he's going, "Oi, oi, 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 what am I going to do? She's driving me crazy. Ah, I know what I'll do. I'll give her the protection she wants. I don't fear God or man, but if I don't give her the protection she wants, she's going to wear me out." And so he turns and he gives her the legal protection she's begging for, and she praises the Lord, and he goes away relieved. I thought that was a great, great little series there. The lesson is perpetual prayer. Perpetual prayer by this widow. And this is especially true in light of the previous paragraph in the second coming. We need to be praying for the salvation of Israel, and we need to be praying for peace of Jerusalem, even now. So, in the parable, the unrighteous judge responds because of persistence. This is a Kal v'chomer argument. How much more is God willing to respond to those who are righteous? How much more he is. You know, the certainty of things to come should be a motivation for our prayers for that event. We should be praying for the second coming of Yeshua, so we can count on prayer requests that are in line with the will of God. So that's the first lesson, perpetual prayer. The second lesson is humble prayer in verses 9 and 10. And he also told this parable to some people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. So we got two men praying here. Here's the tax collector praying very humbly, and here is the Pharisee praying rather proudly, because the Pharisee wants to show off his righteousness. Verses 11 and 12. The Pharisee stood and was praying this to himself, not to God, to himself, basically. God, I thank you that I am not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, and even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes of all that I get. So he did fast twice a week. Monday and Thursday were Pharisaic fast days. That's more than required by the Mosaic law. And they tithed everything possible. And a similar statement is found in the Talmud. Talmud Maaseh Berachot 28b. I give thanks to thee, O Lord, my God, that thou hast set my portion with those who sit in the Beit HaMidrash, in the house of study. And thou hast not set my portion with those who sit in the street corners. For I rise early, and they rise early. But I rise early for words of Torah, and they rise early for frivolous talk. I labor, and they labor. But I labor and receive a reward, and they labor and do not receive a reward. I run, and they run. But I run to life in the future world, and they run to the pit of destruction. Very similar statement, isn't it? God is sure lucky to have this particular Pharisee on his side. Verse 13. But the tax collector, standing some distance away, was even unwilling to lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. Be merciful to me, a sinner. That word merciful means be propitiated. In other words, let your wrath against my sin be appeased. Let your wrath against my sin be satisfied. So he begs for forgiveness. Now, this is not a New Testament. This is not for the New Testament believer. With the death of the Messiah, God has been propitiated. His wrath against our sin has been appeased and satisfied. So all that we have to do is confess. We don't have to beg. 1 John 1:9. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and righteous to forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. We're a very, very fortunate position, aren't we? Now, the publican went home justified, not the Pharisee. He went home justified because of his humble faith. And the motif is in verse 14. I tell you, this man went to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. All right, we're at lesson 9 now, page 59 at the top of the page, section 176, conflict with the Pharisaic teaching on divorce, Matthew 19, Mark 10. Now, in this section 176, we come to a very emotional issue. Divorce is a very emotional issue. And before we start section 176, I want to make two statements. Number one, I always start this section by saying that my remarks are not aimed at anyone. I am not preaching at anyone in particular. Okay? I'm just doing my best to exegete the passage, and that is all. If anyone feels uncomfortable regarding anything I say, remember, you are not my target. I'm not targeting anybody. I'm trying to exegete Scripture. All right, secondly, there are many good teachers who take lots of different positions regarding the issue of divorce. Opinions are all over the map in this issue. It's a difficult issue. Here's the divorce remarriage map, so to speak. Some people feel that divorce is never permitted and remarriage is never permitted. But at the far end of the spectrum, there are those that feel divorce is permitted and remarriage is permitted. In the middle, you've got people who feel divorce is permitted under certain circumstances, but remarriage is never permitted. And then the third position, divorce is permitted under certain circumstances, but remarriage is permitted for the victim. Now, as I make my comments, it's not my intention to contradict or challenge any other position. I'll be simply sharing what I honestly believe the biblical teaches, what the biblical data teaches on divorce. And so you're free to disagree with me. Many good men disagree with me, and many good men agree with me. So you take your pick. So with that said, let's begin. We start with the situation. The location is revealed in Matthew 19, verses 1 and 2. When Yeshua had finished these words, he departed from Galilee and came into the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. So Yeshua is in the area of Judea beyond the Jordan. Perea is another name for it. It's a Jewish area east of the Jordan River called Perea or Judea beyond the Jordan. Now the circumstances are in verse 3. Some Pharisees came to Yeshua, testing him and asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all?" They're testing him. Now, how can this question be a test, since the Pharisees themselves were divided on this issue? Now, the test is for him because he's in Perea. He's out of the jurisdiction of the Sanhedrin, but he's not out of the jurisdiction of Herod Antipas. It's over the issue of divorce and remarriage that John the Baptist lost his head to Herod Antipas. They hope that Yeshua will say something to condemn the marriage of Herod Antipas, and then Herod would have Yeshua beheaded over the same issue. That's the test. That's the issue. All right, now what is the substance of the divorce and remarriage issue? We're at the top of page 60. Now, Tanakh, the Old Testament, teaches that God's desire, is no divorce, but that husbands and wives should reconcile their marriage differences. So God holds a very high view of marriage, Genesis 2:24. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And Malachi 2:16, for I hate divorce, says the Lord, the God of Israel. So marriage is supposed to be a permanent one-flesh relationship. However, God did lay out two grounds for divorce in Tanakh, in the Old Testament. The grounds for divorce are, number one, Deuteronomy 24:1, sexual incompatibility. And then number two, in Ezra and Nehemiah, religious incompatibility. And both Old Testament grounds freed the parties for remarriage. Now, what do the Pharisees think of all this? We're at the heading Ervat Davar, lesson 9, page 60, in the middle of the page. Now, the Pharisees were divided over the proper interpretation of a phrase in Deuteronomy 24:1. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house. Now, the Hebrew phrase is ervat davar, indecency or uncleanness, literally the nakedness of the thing. It's a delicate euphemism for indecent sexual behavior. It's a general, inclusive term that does not pinpoint any one specific type or instance of indecent sexual behavior. So as a result, the rabbis debated the meaning of the expression, and two Pharisaic schools differed in their interpretation of the phrase. We start with the school of Shammai. The school of Shammai had a very, very strict interpretation, a very narrow interpretation. They held to a high view of marriage consistent with God's view of marriage. They only permitted divorce on the basis of adultery. So Shammai took God's standard for marriage seriously and responsibly. Now, this is not the Tanakh's position on adultery, but it was their position at the time of Messiah. All right, so what's the definition of adultery? Adultery is illicit sexual intercourse with a woman or betrothed, with a married or betrothed woman. Now, the biblical punishment for adultery was excommunication, not divorce. It was the death penalty. Not divorce, Leviticus 20:10. If there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. And then Deuteronomy 22:22. If a man is found lying with a married woman, then both of them shall die, the man who lay with the woman and the woman, and thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. So the biblical punishment was execution, the death penalty, not divorce, but the death penalty for both parties. Both parties. So that's the biblical position on adultery. Okay? And this death penalty was also included on any other type of, a number of other types of sexual deviations. The death penalty was issued because of homosexuality. Leviticus 20:13. If there is a man who lies with a male, as those who lie with a woman, both of them have committed a detestable act. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. Now the death penalty was also prescribed in cases of incest. Leviticus 20:11-12. If there's a man who lies with his father's wife, he has uncovered his father's nakedness. Both of them shall be surely be put to death. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. If there's a man who lies with his daughter-in-law, both of them shall surely be put to death. They've committed incest. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. If there is a man who marries a woman and her mother, it is immorality. Both he and they shall be burned with fire, so that there will be no immorality in your midst. And then the death penalty also decreed for bestiality. If there is a man who lies with an animal, he shall surely be put to death. You shall also kill the animal. If there is a woman who approaches any animal to mate with it, you shall kill the woman and the animal. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. So in light of these punishments, Deuteronomy 24:1 would speak of behavior that falls short of adultery or any of these three acts as well. The Old Testament biblical data permits divorce for improper sexual behavior that fell short of adultery. Remember, adultery was a death penalty. But Deuteronomy 24:1 does not categorically define what that behavior is. In other words, probably the best thing you could say is sexual incompatibility. It would be equal to ervat davar. All right, now the other school is the school of Hillel. They were a much more liberal school. You're in the middle of page 61 right now. The school of Hillel said that our ervat davar speaks of uncleanness or anything else. See, the school of Hillel had a low view of marriage that was inconsistent with the biblical revelation. Anything was grounds for divorce. And it reads just that way in the Talmud. Burned dinner were grounds for divorce. Here's Gittin 90a. Mishnah. Beit Shammai say, a man should not divorce his wife unless he has found her guilty of some unseemly conduct. As it says, because he hath found some unseemly thing, ervat davar, in her. Bet Hillel, however, say that he may divorce her even if she has merely spoiled his food, since it says, because he hath found ervat davar, some unseemly thing in her. So anything was grounds for divorce, according to Hillel. Eventually, Rabbi Hillel's position became the recognized position in 90 A.D. Hillelites did not take God's standard seriously or responsibly. However, at the time of Yeshua, this issue was a live debate between these two schools. All right, let's pick it up in Matthew 19:3. Some Pharisees came to Yeshua, testing him and asking him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? And that phrase, for any reason at all, reflects the school of Hillel. No matter how Yeshua answers, however, he will have Pharisees on his side. How he answers is not the test. Rather, it is, will he answer in such a way that will put his life in jeopardy from Herod Antipas? See, they want Herod Antipas mad at him. So Yeshua goes ahead and answers in the bottom of page 61. He'll make 4 points. We'll start with verses 4-6. And he answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. So Yeshua interprets the intent of Genesis 2:24. God's original intent was no divorce. Marriage was to be permanent. But then a question is raised in verse 7, Matthew 19:7. They said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away?" Why did Moses command a bill of divorcement? We're now on page 62 of your outline. We'll read Mark 10:3 through 5 and Matthew 19:8. And he answered and said to them, "What did Moses command you?" And they said, "Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away." But Yeshua said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment." Matthew 19:8. And he said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way." So Moses did not command divorce. He only permitted the practice because of the hardness of hearts, because of unmerciful, unloving, mean hearts. Divorce is never commanded. The ideal is always reconciliation. All right, we'll pick it up in Mark 10:11 and 12. And he said to them, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her, and if she herself divorces her husband and marries another man, she is committing adultery." Now, in this section, Yeshua speaks against the one-sidedness of Jewish tradition in the first century. Yeshua says, adultery goes both ways. In Rabbinic Judaism, the offense only goes one way, against the husband. The woman is always the offender, and the man is considered the innocent party, and the wife the guilty party. But Yeshua teaches a more balanced view that both parties are capable of being guilty of the offense. All right, let's pick it up in Matthew 19, verses 8 and 9. He said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not been this way. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery." So he repeats what he said earlier in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew 5, 31 and 32. It was said, "Whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." So Yeshua says there's only one basis for divorce, and that's immorality. Now, he uses the Greek word porneia in both instances. Now, porneia means to engage in sexual immorality of any kind. So porneia is parallel to ervat davar. Like ervat davar, porneia is a general, inclusive term that does not pinpoint any one specific instance of indecent sexual behavior. A good translation would be immorality, just as the NASB has translated the term. Immorality is a general term, any sexual sin, homosexuality, premarital sex, incest, etc., etc., etc. The question then arises, if immorality is a biblical basis for divorce, then what are the grounds for remarriage? Now on this, there's a division of interpretation among teachers. We're now on page 63 of your outline. Clearly, there are no grounds for remarriage for the guilty party. However, Yeshua is silent regarding the innocent party, the victim. Now, some feel the silence means neither party can remarry. Others feel that his silence indicates that the innocent party may remarry. I take the position that the innocent party may remarry if there is a chance for reconciliation. I take the position that the innocent party may remarry if there is no chance for reconciliation. Now let me repeat that just one more time. I take the position that the innocent party may remarry if there is no chance for reconciliation. Remember, reconciliation must always be our primary goal. That comes first. So I take this position for two reasons. First of all, in first century Jewish culture, remarriage was assumed. In the Old Testament, after a permitted divorce, remarriage was permitted. So I don't think there was a need to state the obvious to his audience. That's why Yeshua is silent on that point of remarriage. Secondly, the position that the innocent party may remarry coincides with my sense of fairness. Here I factor in God's mercy and love. Psalm 86:15. But you, O Lord, are a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness and truth. Psalm 103:13. Just as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. In the New Testament, the Brit HaDashah, James 3:17. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And finally, Matthew 5:7. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. So we must never ignore or forget the character of God. So I would rather not assume that the prohibition applies to the innocent party when it is not so stated. I would rather extend compassion to the innocent party since Yeshua is silent on this point. All right, let's get back to section 176. The disciples liked Hillel's position, you know, typical male chauvinist position. But Yeshua was more in Shammai's camp. Let's pick it up on Matthew 19:10. The disciples came to him. If the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it's better not to marry. Better not to marry if marriage demands such narrow boundaries. If you can't get out of marriage, it's better not to get into marriage. And Jesus goes on to say, verses 11 and 12, but he said to them, not all men can accept this statement, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born that way from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who are made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who are made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to accept this, let him accept it. So, the basic pattern in God's program is for marriage. The only ones who can remain single are those who are given the gift of singleness. And this is explained in 1 Corinthians 7:7, because singleness is a spiritual gift, the spiritual gift of celibacy. 1 Corinthians 7:7. And the context is instruction about marriage. Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am, single. However, each man has his own gift from God, one on this manner and another in that. So celibacy is a gift. But you know, there never seems to be a run on the gift of celibacy. It's a valid spiritual gift, but many believers don't seem to be content with the gift or gifts that they receive. Instead, many people seem to chase after other gifts. Page 64. We need to be content with and we need to use the gift that we receive from God, including the gift of celibacy, if that's your gift. Only if you have this spiritual gift should you plan to stay single. Otherwise, be open to marriage. Now, there are other places in the Bible that speak of the marriage, divorce, remarriage issue, but that's all I'm going to say here. I've said enough, and we're studying the life of Messiah, not the doctrine of marriage. Let's quickly review and summarize what we've been over. First of all, the grounds for divorce in Tanakh, the Old Testament. First of all, A, sexual indecency or incompatibility that falls short of adultery, Deuteronomy 24. And B, religious incompatibility. Now, in both Old Testament grounds, freed the party for remarriage. A biblical divorce, a proper divorce, a permitted divorce in Tanakh was severance of the marriage bond and freed the party for remarriage. Now, in the Brit HaDashah, the New Testament, there are also two permitted reasons for divorce, and they're very similar to Tanakh. The Tanakh grounds for divorce do not apply to us today because we live under the New Covenant. We don't live under the Mosaic Covenant today. But remember, The Old Testament standard was in force during Messiah's ministry. Yeshua was a Jew living under the Mosaic covenant and fulfilling it perfectly. So the Mosaic law was still in effect at that time. Now with Yeshua's death and resurrection, he instituted the new covenant, and we live under that today. So what are the new covenant grounds for divorce? Now you're at the bottom of page 64. So the New Testament grounds for divorce, first of all, A, sexual immorality of any kind, Matthew 19:9. But remember, it's not categorically defined. What sexual immorality is not categorically defined. And this means each situation has to be reviewed on a case-by-case basis, very carefully, very compassionately. And then B, religious incompatibility, a mixed marriage between believers and unbelievers. Rabbi Shaul, the Apostle Paul, says, if the unbeliever wants to stay married, you cannot divorce. You stay married to the unbeliever. 1 Corinthians 7:12 and 13. But to the rest I say, not the Lord, that any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away. However, if the unbeliever wants a divorce, the Christian is not to fight it, but to grant the divorce, verses 15 and 16. Yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. But God has called us to peace. And how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? So in both of the above cases, I feel that remarriage for the victim only is permitted if reconciliation is not possible. And remember, others feel that remarriage is absolutely not permitted. But remember also that reconciliation should always be foremost in our thinking. If reconciliation is not possible, I want to emphasize that, I feel remarriage of the innocent party is permissible. Now, before we go on, let me comment briefly on two other questions that come up. First of all, what if someone is divorced improperly before becoming a Christian? Now, in this case, I would apply the principle of 2 Corinthians 5:17. Therefore, if anyone is in Messiah, he is a new creature. The old things passed away, behold, new things have come. I would say start fresh. 2 Corinthians 5:17 is a very, very Jewish statement. Very Jewish statement. You are a new creature in the Messiah. The Greek word here is very strong. It doesn't speak of reformation. It refers to a new birth, a brand new start, a new creation. So if you were divorced before becoming a Christian, start fresh and live by the biblical standards of behavior. But secondly, what if you were divorced improperly and remarried after becoming a Christian? Well, two things you need to do. Number one, you need to apply the Christian's wash rag, 1 John 1:9. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and righteous to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. First thing you need to do is confess your sin and receive cleansing. And then the second thing you need to do, you should do everything possible to make your current marriage a God-honoring success. Go on and make your current marriage a success. And remember, good men feel differently about this issue. So what you should do is to review the different positions and decide in your own mind which is best between you and God. All right, section 177, lesson 9, page 66 at the top of the page. Examples of little children in relation to the kingdom. And we'll read Mark 10:13-16. And they were bringing children to him so that he might touch them. But the disciples rebuked them. But when Yeshua saw this, he was indignant and said to them, "Permit the children to come to me. Do not hinder them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as these. Truly I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God like a child will not enter it at all." And he took them in his arms and began blessing them, laying his hands on them. And here's a beautiful little illustration of Yeshua blessing this young child. I always wonder, what happened to the children that Yeshua blessed? How did their lives turn out? Well, I guess I'll get to talk to some of them when I get to the kingdom myself. But the means of entering the kingdom is childlike faith. Childlike faith. All right, let's close with some thoughts of application. And the theme I chose was three lessons by Yeshua. Now, Yeshua is instructing his disciples in preparation for the time they will be without him. Now, the first thing we looked at is the instruction to the nation as a whole. The sign of the prophet Jonah is given. Some believe, some reject. Then he gave instruction on prayer. Be persistent, be humble. Then he gave instruction concerning divorce, which we've just looked at. So let's get personal. What lesson is most meaningful to you? Perhaps Yeshua is teaching you another lesson than these three. Write down the lesson that Yeshua is teaching you. One of these three or another one. And then move on. Make a plan of action. What can you do to make that lesson a practical part of your life? All right, this brings us to the end of lesson 9, and we've come to lesson 10. And so we won't get into lesson 10 in this particular segment. But as you turn the page to lesson 10, page 1, you'll see your table of contents for lesson 10. Starts at part 9, the ministry of Messiah around Perea, covered in sections 178 through 184. And then we come to part 10, the formal presentation of Messiah to Israel and the resulting conflict, beginning in section 185, down to the bottom of the page, section 199, and on page 2, continuing, section 192 to 195. So that's the upcoming table of contents for lesson number 10. All right, so we'll pick it up. We'll pick it up next session in lesson 10 and section 178, dealing with riches and the kingdom. Again, so glad that you've been here for this study, and we welcome you back for the next lessons to come, and I think you'll find them edifying and helpful in your walk with Yeshua. Again, thanks so much for being our students. We'll see you later. Lehitraot! Lehitraot!